This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
Talk about activism and many people think Greenpeace. But what is Greenpeace doing to help save our climate? Today we're fortunate to reach a busy man. He's Gavin Edwards, Climate Campaign Director for Greenpeace International. We find him at a gathering of world activists in the Netherlands. Gavin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there, Alex.
Hi. Well, let's start with the conference you attended today. After the dismal failure of the climate meetings in Copenhagen last December, what is the mood of people where you are?
As you say, Copenhagen was a major political moment, a massive opportunity to tackle climate change. We had a good public consensus on the drivers of climate change. We had world leaders getting themselves to Copenhagen. We had a global spotlight on it. And what we had at the end of it was a complete failure of leadership by nations around the world. And I could single out a few nations, but the vast majority of nations were not nearly as constructive as we needed to be. And we saw things literally fall apart in the last couple of days. While that is very bad and very tragic news, there was also a little bit of a silver lining and then some good news, which is this growing movement that's coming together on climate change around the world. What we saw in Copenhagen was people from all different parts of the world and different NGOs, not just non-governmental organizations, sort of the usual suspects like Greenpeace or World Wildlife Fund. We saw more and more development NGOs like Oxfam and others come on board in a very, very big way. We saw trade unions come on board, and we're seeing this real broadening out of a movement that's really growing in strength. So while we were disheartened by the efforts of world leaders, the efforts of civil society were strong and are only going to get stronger in the next couple of years. And that's certainly the mood here today as I sit with other leaders of other NGOs from around the world.
Well, getting back to Greenpeace, could you describe your job for our listeners?
Yeah, I've been working for the last 3.5 years heading up Greenpeace's climate campaign globally, which means that we're responsible for working with colleagues at Greenpeace International and 40 Greenpeace offices around the world to basically craft campaigns to tackle climate change, tackle renewable energy supply, tackle energy efficiency, tackle nuclear power. All of these things are interrelated. And so I've essentially been plugging away, trying to work and strengthen our campaigns wherever we can. I've personally been working much more in Asia as well and trying to really work with our colleagues in China and India so that we can have a really, truly global movement alongside the work that we do in Europe and North America and Latin America as well.
Well, that's one of the things I like about Greenpeace, though a lot of the funding comes from supporters in developed countries. Your organization went into the developing world early, opening offices in countries like Brazil and India. So this is really paying off now for a global campaign like the climate?
I think so, yeah. We've got strong and up-and-coming campaigns and strong campaigners in Delhi, in Beijing, in Brasilia. So people that have been working at this for a few years now, in different parts of the world, which is really important. The last thing you want is from something that was born as a Western organization, born as an organization from Vancouver, Canada, necessarily dictating what the developing world should do. You need people that live and breathe the issues in those countries to actually have a really strong voice and a really strong say in what the issues of today are and how to solve them.
And can you run us through some of the climate actions that Greenpeace did in this past year?
Yeah, we have quite a heavy year. We were pretty determined to push Copenhagen up the political agenda and push governments, certain governments, quite hard as well. And that's a very big bag of tricks and tactics that we use as Greenpeace to really raise alarm bells, to hold governments accountable, the whole corporations accountable. So I'll just give you a flavor, one from Canada, where we had quite a big campaign up in the tar sands north of Edmonton to highlight the ongoing extraction of tar sands and the complete abdication of responsibility of the Harper government in tackling climate change by developing tar sands. So that's been very big, and as well as that, actually highlighting in places like France the role of Total oil in the tar sands as well. So that involves activists out in very remote areas actually climbing on top of the massive bulldozers and trucks that you actually see up in the tar sands there. I'll take another example, which is the U.S. We were really keen to push Obama in the last year to take a lead on climate change. So we went to Mount Rushmore, a famous landmark in the U.S., with the heads of four U.S. presidents. etched into the rock in a national monument. We hung a very big banner of Obama demanding leadership from him, and basically with the message, you know, if you want to be a climate leader, you're going to need to tackle climate change, and real leaders end up with a face on a rock like Mount Rushmore. So that was another act of civil disobedience we did as well. I can go on and on and on. I'll pick a couple of other kind of more unusual ones. We had a very big activity in Beijing, always a very difficult place to organize standard Greenpeace protests in a place like China, but we managed to get a local artist to work on some ice sculptures of children, essentially, life-size sculptures of children made of ice, and they were put out in a traditional Beijing courtyard and left to melt in the sun as a way of a silent protest to show what's at stake with climate change if we don't tackle it. We also managed to hang a small banner as well at a coal power station in China as well. So that gives you a little bit of a flavor of some of the action side of things that we've been doing over the last 12 months.
Right, and you were also part of a successful campaign to stop the expansion at King's North in UK.
That's right, yeah. We've been working the last few years to really push the Brown government in the UK to basically make coal a leadership issue for the Brown government and for governments around the world. If you're building coal-fired power plants, you're not tackling climate change. It's a very simple message. Coal is the single biggest contributor to climate change globally as well. So after a multi-year campaign involving activists climbing on the existing King's North coal plant and camping out there, after some really strong political work, after a lot of mobilization, a lot of other more grassroots groups going to King's North, camping out there and making it an issue for the UK government, and that has been shelved for the time being. So that's another important victory that we've chalked up in the last 12 months as well.
Gavin Edwards, lately I've interviewed some scientists who are close to panic about the damage to our climate, perhaps lasting 100,000 years or more. And at the same time, major newspapers like the Times of London and the Washington Post still manage to declare that global warming is all a fraudulent scare. How do you see this latest phase of denialism?
Well, we expected after Copenhagen some kind of a backlash from one or two parts of the media. We have a number of people out there that are continually looking to undermine the science of climate change and plant seeds of doubt. Some of these actors out there are actually fueled by the fossil fuel industry themselves, who have a big stake in the status quo. And so it's not surprising that once in a while they'll find a way to try and exploit anything possible to try and create this idea that it's an unsolved question when it comes to the science of climate change. I think the irony for us is, you know, the links between CO2, carbon dioxide, and the potential for a warming of the Earth is something that's been established in the late 1800s as a scientific hypothesis and have been tested continually since then. And when it got to 2007, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued their groundbreaking fourth assessment report, as far as the world was concerned, the science has basically been established, cut and dry at that point. What we've seen in the last few weeks is further attempts to try and basically plant those seeds of doubt to try and stall any action on climate change. And so, of course, it's pretty upsetting when you see that, when you see reporters falling for that, when you see some of the issues out there that are being completely overamplified. It is a bit disturbing. I think in one case, you know, with the IPCC, there was a footnote that was mistaken and wrong. But that doesn't mean to say you throw the whole science out when you've got quite a few papers, quite a few reports put together to summarize the IPCC science, to reject it because of one mistake in a footnote or something seems absurd to us. It would be like basically rejecting the existence of God if you found a typo in the Bible. And that just seems a little bit ludicrous.
It does indeed. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the Netherlands. Our guest is Gavin Edwards, Climate Campaign Director for Greenpeace International. Well, you talked a little bit about Greenpeace work in China. What about other parts of Asia, say India, for example?
Yeah, we have quite an active campaign there, tackling coal and tackling climate change as well. We had an interesting case there where the Indian government was correctly saying that the emissions per capita of the average Indian person is much, much less than your average North American. It's just over about a ton of carbon per person, or a little bit more versus, you know, up to 19, 20 tons for your average Canadian or American. So on the face of it, you would say, why does India need to actually take action? And the answer, of course, is everybody has a responsibility to take some kind of action to tackle climate change. And our colleagues in India were not very happy with the fact that the Indian government was hiding behind this argument that overall India is a lot less bad than Western society. So they actually did a study and found out that your average wealthy middle-class Indian has basically a lifestyle approaching that of your average European, or in some cases North American as well. And they found it was the politicians that had this lifestyle that were essentially saying, India doesn't have to do anything because our emissions on the whole are low. So we coined the phrase hiding behind the poor, and basically said Indian politicians are actually hiding behind people in India that have no access to electricity, have no access to power, but aren't actually cleaning up their own act in terms of, you know, pushing for new coal-fired power stations to be built and these kinds of things when other alternatives exist. So that's been quite successful at challenging folks in the within civil society in India, within the media, and within politics as well. And that's actually been one of the factors in shifting the Indian government's position from a do-nothing approach to a, yeah, we need to take a second look at this, we need to figure out how to incorporate solar energy into our development pathway, and these kinds of solutions as well.
And listeners, currently at greenpeace.org, there's a striking photo presentation on islands called the Sundarbans, where thousands are threatened by more powerful storms and rising seas. So you can check that out. It looks like the people of India may suffer more from the impacts of climate change than we do here, say, in North America or in Europe.
Absolutely, and that's one of the inequalities, the vast inequalities of climate change. The people that are most responsible in terms of the amount of CO2 that's been put up in the atmosphere so far tend to be from Northern Europe or North America, and tend to either live in places that are less sensitive to the impacts of climate change or live in such a way that they would have maybe the wealth to try and help protect themselves from it. The Dutch in the Netherlands, where I live, of course, are very famous for building bigger and bigger dikes, which is something you're going to need in a country like this. But there's a gross inequality there if you live in Bangladesh or in the Sundarbans there, in the feature that you're mentioning, where you've got communities living right on the poverty line without access to energy, with crop failures once in a while, with the potential for a much more erratic monsoon season, with the potential for some more flooding down the Ganges as well. You put all those impacts together on communities that are barely getting by, and you can see the kind of devastation that will happen in years to come. And in fact, we put a report out a couple of years ago which estimated about 125 million people would have to start migrating just in the Ganges Delta region because of the impacts of climate change, with the forecasting we did with the local university there. And so that just gives you an idea of the scale of things to come if we don't actually tackle climate change soon.
And what about the European Union? I've heard rumors that climate is slipping off the EU's agenda. Would that be your perception?
Certainly, we were expecting a lot more out of the European Union in Copenhagen. They became a little kind of a lame sideshow compared to the US, compared to China and others, and really didn't voice themselves as strongly or take the leadership role that we would expect of Europe and that we've sometimes seen them take in the past. And the science is pretty clear that you have to cut emissions. If you're a wealthy country or a wealthy set of countries like Europe or Canada or the US, you have to cut emissions by 40% below 1990 levels by 2020. The Europeans were basically saying, we'll cut them by 20%, maybe we'll cut by 30% if other countries do the same. We've been really challenging Europe to step up and say, go to 40%, at least go to 30% and get on the pathway to 40%. And Europe is stuck on 20 right now, and is stuck in the debate on 20%. So that's worrying. It's, of course, that's a step up from the Harper government in Canada or from Obama in the US, but it's still not far enough, still not true leadership. So that's one issue I think that we have to address and we have to push much, much harder on in Europe. The other reality in Europe is that the fossil fuel industry still has an inordinate amount of influence, as does the car industry, over the European politics, and Eastern European countries that are heavily dependent on coal can also have some undue influence as well. So unless we can actually deal with some of those fundamental drivers, we're never going to see Europe take a stronger position, as the science of climate change is telling Europe to do.
Gavin, looking forward, what will the Greenpeace climate campaign emphasize in the coming year?
As I said, we're regrouping now after Copenhagen. We're figuring out what next. In terms of a global deal on climate change, the next meeting through the UN process, the next major meeting is in Cancun in Mexico at the end of this year. We're evaluating now whether the political conditions can be put in place for a really strong deal at that meeting, or whether it becomes another moment where we can continue to build and strengthen and deepen this movement of climate change activism around the world. So that's going to be one key tenet for this year, and I think for the next years to come as well. How can this movement continue to grow? How can we engage people in deeper and deeper ways, which can start, if you've never done anything on climate change before or anything on environmental issues before, it can be as simple as changing your light bulb. But we always urge, don't stop there. That's your first action. That's your entry-level action into activism, and you need to take stronger and stronger action over time. It can move up to petitions. It can be move up to greater activism. It can move up to eventually climbing up on a coal plant or over into the tar sands and actually physically stopping the destruction of or the burning of fossil fuels. There are all sorts of things that people can do to engage along that spectrum, depending on where you are in the world and depending on your comfort level in activism, but that's what it's actually going to take. And so this year we'll be working really, really hard to actually figure out how to engage many, many more people. So that's going to be one key plank of the Greenpeace campaign. We'll also be very, very heavily focused on coal and the burning of coal as well. And we're currently identifying coal power stations around the world that are proposed to be built in the next 1 to 2 to 3 years and figuring out how we can build opposition to them. And directly or through the planning permits for those power stations or through government policy or through consumer power, there are a number of approaches we can take there as well.
Well, I have to be honest with you. At times, I think we are losing this fight and losing any control over the future climate. How do you manage to keep on going even as emissions continue to rise?
I think when you really get a feel for the kind of imperative that we face, for what is actually at stake in tackling climate change, that can really, really focus your mind. When, like myself, who was a forest activist, started off my activism in British Columbia and worked to really help protect different parts of British Columbia's coastal temperate rainforest, up in the Great Bear Rainforest and on Vancouver Island, and you realize that those victories, the work I've done in the Amazon, all of those victories can be threatened in a climate-changing world. And that really focuses your mind as well. And I think we know that sooner or later, the world will finally wake up and actually do something on a much, much bigger scale. We're already seeing, you know, a few years ago, people didn't really believe in renewable energy as a solution. We're seeing that take off today. We're seeing, as I said earlier, the Indian government embracing solar power now. My local electricity provider here in the Netherlands guarantees me 100% wind energy power for my electricity. So we're seeing the startings of the right solutions in place, while at the same time rapidly running out of time to tackle it. So I take my motivation from those small steps forward and from what's at stake if we do nothing as well. And that's how personally I keep myself going. And then maybe lastly, once in a while, I just see some really, truly inspiring actions as well. You know, I met someone in Copenhagen that had been hunger striking for almost over 35 to 40 days, I think, altogether, without food as a way of protesting the fact that governments from around the world were not taking the issue seriously. When you see that kind of conviction, when you see activists from Greenpeace climbing on coal power stations and spending day after day there, when you see people like some of my colleagues that went to jail for over 21 days over Christmas simply for showing up at a world leaders summit in Copenhagen, a dinner summit in Copenhagen, and you see that kind of action by people, you can get a lot of inspiration from that too. That's also very important as well.
Well, as we wrap up, is there something I missed or something that you would like to tell our listeners?
I think the key is this is the defining issue of our times, climate change. It cuts across every other issue that you might care about or want to get engaged in, whether you're a social activist, an environmental activist, you believe in fighting poverty, whatever the issues are that really inspire you, climate change will touch upon each and every one of those and make each and every one of those issues that much harder or impossible to solve on its own. So climate change, in a way, could be a great uniter of people around the world in tackling an issue, and it can only be one from a global perspective as well. You can't just do something in your own backyard and expect to solve the problem globally. You have to work locally, but you have to work globally as well. So I think this is, as well as a massive threat, it's a massive opportunity as well. And I just urge everyone out there, listeners out there, to figure out how you can get more engaged yourself, how you can get your families engaged, how you can get your neighbors engaged, and keep ramping up the pressure, taking that extra next step that you thought you may never take until eventually world leaders will have no choice but to listen.
From the Netherlands, we've been talking with the key organizer behind the scenes, Gavin Edwards, director of the Climate Campaign for Greenpeace International. Find out more at greenpeace.org. Thank you for sharing with us, Gavin.
Hey, thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In breaking news, Gavin Edwards tells me he's taking a sabbatical to work on his master's while still advising Greenpeace campaigns. Meanwhile, the climate campaign will be directed by Stefan Brockman and, in a surprise return to Greenpeace, Zipporah Berman. Zipporah was the famous face of the Clackwit and Great Bear rainforest campaigns, founder of both Forest Ethics and Power Up Canada. She will work out of Amsterdam for up to 2 years. Just in case you aren't sure yet, let's go back to our sneak preview. From broadcaster and military specialist Gwyn Dyer, in a speech I recorded February 2nd.
An interesting thing happened last summer, but it wasn't explained. When the G8, you know, the Group of Eight, the big powers met, and then shortly after that, the G20, which is all the rich great powers plus all the emerging great powers, China, India, Brazil, met in Italy last summer, July, they all adopted this target that we must never allow the global warming to exceed 2 degrees Celsius. That is to say, 2 degrees hotter than the average temperature in 1990. That's the baseline. But they didn't tell us why. By the time the 192 countries showed up in Copenhagen in December, they'd all adopted this target, but the governments weren't telling people why. So I'll tell you why. The why is because if you go above 2 degrees, you hit the feedbacks, and you lose control of the climate. See, we've got control of the climate at the moment. It's our emissions that are causing the warming, so we could always decide to turn them off and stop the warming. It is our emissions from burning fossil fuels, and we can and should stop burning fossil fuels over a fairly short schedule, say 25 or 30 years, and substitute other ways of generating power, right? And you've got a whole bunch of available technologies, market-ready, on the shelf, wind power, solar power, wave and tidal power, geothermal power, nuclear power. You can do it. Bit of a tricky bit replacing the liquid fuels we run our transportation with, but I could tell you what we could do there, too. It's not quite market-ready, but the solutions are being worked on. It's not a question of the technology being unavailable. We can turn off our emissions. The warming won't stop right away, because when you put the carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, there's a sort of delayed action effect. Carbon dioxide gives you about half the warming it's eventually going to give you in 10 years and the rest over the next 100. So we are currently in a situation where we've only had 0.8 of a degree of warming since 1990, but there's enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that we've churned out since 1990 that has not yet exerted its full warming effect, that there's another 0.7 of a degree of warming in the atmosphere. We're committed. It's too late, though you're not feeling it yet. Well, 0.8 and 0.7 is 1.5, and we're never supposed to go above 2. So we haven't got a lot of room for maneuver here, and what happens above 2 is that we lose control. That's why you must not go above 2. Above 2 degrees, the warming itself triggers natural processes that cause further emissions of carbon dioxide beyond our control to stop. The permafrost around the Arctic starts to melt. And locked up in that million square kilometers of permafrost is enough carbon dioxide to double the amount in the atmosphere. I was in Yellowknife not too long ago. I gave a talk rather similar to this, and a guy came up to me afterwards, a native guy, and he said, you know what they're doing in our village in the summer? And I said, no. He lives about 200K west of Yellowknife. He said, well, you know, there's melt ponds in the summer on the permafrost. The top layer melts, and you get these melt ponds, and you can see the gas bubbling up through them, carbon dioxide, but also methane gas, another greenhouse gas, which is inflammable. So the kids get the kitchen matches, and they go out on the land, and they set the melt ponds on fire. Some of them burn all summer. It's starting to happen now, but, you know, short of 2 degrees of warming, the great bulk of the permafrost probably doesn't melt, so you're okay. The other major source of carbon dioxide that we're going to see coming from natural sources if the warming goes past 2 is that the oceans start giving up the carbon dioxide they absorbed in past times, because warmer water can contain less dissolved gas. It's the cold beer principle. You buy a glass of brew, and it's full of those charming little bubbles of carbon dioxide and frosty, And if you chug it down right away, you get the full benefit. And if you get called away to the phone or, you know, meet a cute person and get involved in 20 minutes of conversation and the beer warms up, by the time you get back to it, it's gone flat because it warmed up. Well, warm oceans go flat too. They start to lose the carbon dioxide that they previously absorbed. And somewhere north of 2, but not that far north of 2, the oceans become a source of carbon dioxide. And like the permafrost, you can't stop it. You can't refreeze the permafrost. You can't cool the ocean. So you must not go past 2. Governments know that. That's why they put that 2-degree limit, though they haven't figured out how to observe it, but they've named it as the limit we must not go beyond. It's because you get into uncontrollable warming. We lose control. We could, after that, cut our own emissions to about 0 and find that we were still on a warming trend because the stuff that's coming out of the permafrost in the oceans has set up its own cycle. It causes more warming. That causes further emissions of carbon dioxide from the ocean and the permafrost. Vicious circle. And you're trapped on an escalator that's taking you up through 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees, the places you really, really never want to go, and you can't turn it off. So 2 is the limit. The soldiers know that. The governments know that. And the soldiers look at that and they see lots of jobs for themselves. So you've had my first conclusion. Here's the second. The generals are right. There will be lots of jobs for the soldiers in a warming world. Basically, because the principal impact of global warming on human beings is through the food supply. The rule of thumb, very rough and ready, that the scientists apply is that for every degree Celsius of warming, you lose 10% of global food production. It's not evenly distributed, 10% everywhere. The closer you are to the equator, the bigger the hit you take. So if you're in the tropics or the subtropics, it's probably going to be more than that. If you're way up here in Canada, it's probably going to be less in the lower levels of warming, not by the time we hit 7, but, you know, down in the lower levels, we're still okay. You could do with a little bit extra warmth in this country, and it probably wouldn't hurt the agriculture anyway, up to maybe, you know, 1 or 2 degrees. But the countries in the tropics and the subtropics get hammered. In the subtropics, it's mainly the problem of the rainfall, which is already pretty sparse there, declining further. In the tropics, it's straight heat. Most of the crops that are grown in the tropics, rice, for example, were domesticated in much cooler climates, and they're right near the top of their temperature tolerance in the tropics, and if you add another couple of degrees, the rice simply doesn't germinate anymore. Over 35 degrees, rice will not form the grains that are the whole point of raising the plant. And in a lot of the tropics, give them 2 degrees, 3 degrees extra, and they're over 35. So, unevenly distributed, but serious losses of food supply in a world which is barely feeding itself.
That was Gwyn Dyer, courtesy of a special presentation by Vancouver Community College Arts and Science. My thanks to the college and Dr. Dyer for permission to broadcast these excerpts from a developing work, likely for television. And that's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Write me anytime, radio@ecoshock.org. Our weekly radio blog has more links for this program. Just go to our website, ecoshock.org, and click on blog. This show entry is February 18th, 2010. I'm Alex. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week as we confront the horrible and fight off our impossible future.